Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising. This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Valerie Sanderson, and in the early hours of Sunday, the 2nd of February, these are our main stories. The coronavirus crisis puts more pressure on China as medical staff in neighbouring Hong Kong threaten to strike unless the border is shut. The Arab League angrily rejects President Trump's Middle East peace plan. South African police have made dozens of arrests after a dispute between illegal miners left 9 people dead. Also in this podcast, was the deaf composer Beethoven able to hear his final symphony after all? We begin with the latest on efforts to tackle the new coronavirus. As we record this podcast, the disease is known to have killed 294 people in China, and more countries are imposing travel restrictions on people who've recently been there. Now, thousands of hospital workers in Hong Kong are calling for the border with China to be sealed to try to stem the spread of the disease. If that doesn't happen, they're threatening to strike. Ivan Lok is an official of the union behind the strike call.
The whole action or strike is to prevent the outbreak, because the government do not do the right thing to prevent the outbreak. That is why we're not requesting for democracy at this moment.
Our Asia-Pacific editor Michael Bristow told me more about the medical workers' call.
What they're demanding is that the Hong Kong authorities close the territory's border with China. They say that's the best way to stop the virus spreading from mainland China, where most cases are at the moment, and coming into Hong Kong, where at the moment they have only 13 cases. The reason they're doing this, though, is that memories are quite long, and just 15, 16 years ago, the SARS outbreak really affected Hong Kong very badly. About 300 people died. They're worried something similar will happen again.
Even though the World Health Organization says don't close borders.
Even though the WHO has said exactly that. In fact, on Friday, Hong Kong's leader, Carrie Lam, came out and said she wouldn't close the borders because of that reason. She said the World Health Organization says we should keep borders open. And then people will cross through official points. We can monitor and check their health, stop the spread of the disease that way. If you close the borders, people might try to get around them, come in anyway. You have no way of monitoring those people.
And is this nurses and doctors as well as anyone who works in the hospitals?
It is. At the moment, only about 10% of doctors, nurses and other staff who work in hospitals have said that they will join the strike. But this does include several hundred doctors and several thousand nurses. What the strikers plan to do is that at first its non-essential staff will begin. If the government continues to refuse to close the border, then doctors and nurses, more frontline staff, will join in. And at that point, they will only offer very limited emergency services in Hong Kong. And so they're essentially reserving the right to increase their action if the authorities refuse to listen to their demands.
Is there any connection to the pro-democracy movement to this action? Because we've seen months of unrest in Hong Kong between activists and the authorities.
I don't think so, really. I think it's mainly looking back to SARS and the effect on Hong Kong, which is motivating people to take this action. But I certainly think it's an indication that there are workers in Hong Kong, people in Hong Kong, who feel emboldened to take action, to speak out and to go on strike if they think the authorities are not doing what they ought to be doing. So really it all feeds into this general atmosphere that Hong Kong is a place where individuals feel they have a right to take action against the government.
Michael Bristow. The Secretary General of the Arab League has condemned President Trump's Middle East peace plan, saying it would subject the Palestinians to permanent Israeli occupation. Ahmed Abul Gait was addressing an emergency meeting of the League called to discuss the American initiative, which was unveiled on Tuesday. Our Middle East analyst Alan Johnston reports.
Mr. Abul Gait said President Trump's plan would create a situation close to apartheid in which Palestinians would be second-class citizens. This, he said, would never bring peace. Instead, it would lead to decades of dispute. The Palestinian president, Mahmoud Abbas, also addressed the meeting in Cairo. He delivered a scathing assessment of every element of the American plan. It envisages granting Palestinians limited sovereignty in pockets of territory while giving Israel control of Jerusalem, the Jordan Valley, and Jewish settlements in the occupied West Bank. The Israeli leadership has enthusiastically embraced the plan, but President Abbas reiterated that he wanted none of it.
I won't accept this solution, and I won't have it written in my history or in my country's history that I have sold Jerusalem.
The Arab League meeting ended with a statement rejecting Mr. Trump's plan, describing it as unfair to the Palestinians. Mr. Abbas will now go on trying to build support for his position elsewhere in the international community. The US and Israel will condemn this effort. They'll cast Mr. Abbas as a man rejecting the last best offer of something like a state that his people will ever get.
Alan Johnston. South African police have made dozens of arrests after a dispute between illegal miners left 9 people dead. Grant Ferret reports on the background to the violence.
Illegal mining is a growing problem in South Africa and violence within the sector is rife. But the discovery of the bodies on the streets of Matholeville, a township on the outskirts of Johannesburg on Friday, provides a shocking reminder of the severity of the problem. The illegal miners, known in South Africa as Zamazamas, or those who try their luck, were beaten to death with stones. One survivor suffered serious injuries. Police described it as a barbaric crime. The exact cause of the killings is unclear, but they took place shortly after police had carried out raids in the area. All those who died and the 87 people who were held for questioning are from neighbouring Lesotho, which has one of the highest official rates of unemployment in the world. The miners work in dangerous, unregulated conditions, often in abandoned shafts around Johannesburg, usually for gold, much of which ends up in Dubai. But in recent years, this illegal industry has spread across the country and now involves other minerals, including diamonds, as well as coal. And as the sector grows, there's increasing evidence of the involvement of criminal gangs linked to people smuggling and extortion. The South African government believes the Zamazamas are not only endangering their own lives, but also costing the country hundreds of millions of dollars in lost production and tax revenue.
Grant Ferret. The Los Angeles Lakers basketball team paid tribute to its former superstar Kobe Bryant on Friday night in the first game since Bryant's helicopter crashed a week ago, killing him and 8 others, including his young daughter. Riley Carlson reports.
Friday night in the house that Kobe built. Thousands of fans and his basketball family pay tribute to the late Lakers superstar. At center court, a cellist. On the jumbotron overhead, the names of the 9 people killed in the crash, including Bryant's 13-year-old daughter, Gigi.
At this time, please join the Los Angeles Lakers, the Portland Trail Blazers, and the entire global basketball family in a 24.2-second moment of silence to honor the lives lost on Sunday.
24.2. 24 is the last number Kobe wore as a Laker. 2 is the number Gigi wore on her basketball jerseys. 2 seats at center court were left open in remembrance, draped in those jerseys and laid with flowers. Outside the arena, as they have for nearly a week, fans gathered at the memorial growing near the entrance.
I was surprised to see how much it affected me as soon as I got here and saw these makeshift memorials.
I've been watching him for 20 years since he came into the league, and I just love him, and I just want to thank him for everything he has done for us here in L.A.
Kobe was a real symbol, you know, of just hard work, dedication, really putting your all in into your passions, you know, your craft. I think a lot of us, you know, were able to kind of connect to him in that sense.
That sentiment was echoed by Lakers forward LeBron James, foregoing some prepared remarks for a heartfelt speech instead.
The one thing that we always shared is that determination to just want to win and just want to be great. And the fact that I'm here now means so much to me. I want to continue along with my teammates to continue his legacy, not only for this year, But as long as we can play the game of basketball that we love, because that's what Kobe Bryant will want. So in the words of Kobe Bryant, Mamba out. But in the words of us, not forgotten. Live on, brother.
LeBron James ending that report from Riley Carlson. Still to come in this podcast, after Brexit, the dilemma for the British living in France.
Would I become French?
England is my home and Britain's my home, but to stay here, I would.
The Australian capital, Canberra, is the latest city to be threatened by the wildfires that have been raging in the country for months. The emergency services chief there has warned that bushfires burning in a national park for the past week may spread to populated areas south of the city. The fires have now burned through 45,000 hectares, or 15% of the entire Canberra area. And the official says residents of the southern suburbs might need to evacuate their homes. The Australian Capital Territory's emergency controller, Georgina Whelan, said the fires are incredibly fierce.
The issue we have with the fire activity is that the fire itself is generating its own weather pattern. And that, combined with the wind direction, is what is driving that intensity in the fire. Consequently, we've had to withdraw our firefighting efforts, direct firefighting efforts, which is why aerial attack is what we'll be undertaking.
Nick Miles spoke to our correspondent in Canberra, Shaima Khalil.
We are in the southern suburbs of Canberra. I'm in the suburb of Banks, and it's just overlooking, while I'm speaking to you, I'm actually looking opposite and watching the fire in the Namanji National Park blaze through. It has been downgraded now to watch and act as opposed to emergency, but it's still going. It's been going for a week now, and people have been told to watch closely for a change in the fire behavior. They're told the fire is still active, and of course you've got the combination of sweltering heat. I mean, today was really, really hot. The wind picking up and tinder dry landscape, and that really is how things could get worse. I think one of the big issues as well is the embers, because they jump ahead, way ahead of the actual fire front, and they cause their own blazes. We understand right now that embers from this fire have jumped across the border, if you will, the state border, and started spot fires in towns in New South Wales, and these fires are now burning at an emergency level. That's how fluid the situation is, and that's why people are being told to watch carefully.
Earlier, we were being told that the fire had actually jumped across a big motorway and that people were being advised actually not to leave the area, but it was too late to do that. They were being advised to hunker down.
That's right. That motorway is the main highway. It's the Manara Highway. And this is the highway that links the southern suburbs and the rural areas to Canberra. A large portion of that has been closed because of these fires that are burning at an emergency level. Some people have left, but those who haven't and decided to stay and defend their homes have been told that they should not get on the highway now, that it's too dangerous and that they should stay in their homes and take shelter in a solid structure. That emergency situation is still ongoing. The fire chief, Shane Fitzsimmons, have been saying that it's going to be a difficult few hours for them to contain. Again, it's the problem, you know, the firefighters, the people, the residents are at the mercy of things that they can't control, which is the wind, the heat and the drought. And that's what's been happening in New South Wales at the moment. The other concern, if you will, is the fact that if these fires grow, they can merge into mega blazes. That hasn't happened yet. And that's what the firefighters are trying to stop.
Shaima Khalil talking to Nick Miles. The Maldives have rejoined the Commonwealth after a gap of 4 years. The move makes the South Asian island nation the 54th member of the Commonwealth, a political association of member states, most of them former territories of the British Empire. Eletra Naismith reports.
The Maldives first joined the Commonwealth in 1982, 17 years after gaining independence from Britain. But in 2016, it quit after being threatened with suspension over its poor record on human rights and democratic reform. Its then-president, Abdullah Yameen, stood accused of a crackdown on political rivals, the courts and the media. But in a shock result just 2 years later, he was replaced by Ibrahim Mohamed Saleh, a pro-democracy campaigner pledging change after years of political turmoil and promising to make the Maldives a Commonwealth nation once again.
Eletra Naismith. With the UK now officially out of the European Union, an 11-month period of transition is underway to hammer out the details of the future relationship between Britain and the 27 remaining members of the Continental Club. The French President Emmanuel Macron has written an open letter, published in the British newspaper The Times, expressing his sadness at the UK's departure, but also extolling the unrivalled ties between the two countries. Here's our Europe regional editor, Mike Saunders.
President Macron's letter is evidence of the soul-searching among European leaders about how they could have let Brexit happen. Mr. Macron says national leaders have often tended to blame the EU for their own failings, but he admits that the EU is not seen as effective or protective enough and too distant from daily realities. He acknowledges a feeling in Britain that France was tough in negotiations. He insists it was not out of bureaucratic inflexibility, but to defend the very foundations of Europe, including the single market. He warns that if Britain wants easy access, it has to stick close to EU rules.
Meanwhile, new figures from France suggest that the number of British people owning property there has fallen since the Brexit referendum in 2016. But in some pockets of the country, estate agents have reported a Brexit boost, with British buyers in a race to find a home there. Our Paris correspondent Lucy Williamson has been to the town of Amiens in the Dordogne.
Karen Webb and her husband Howard came to Europe to find a lifestyle they say Britain has lost. The kennels they run in the Dordogne have been home for them and their 12-year-old daughter Emma since April. They feel British more than European, they say, but are determined to stay on this side of the Channel after Brexit, whatever it takes.
Would I become French? England is my home, and Britain's my home, but to stay here I would. Yes, I would. You know, deep down I'm British, but to live here, to have a better way of life for my daughter, I would, you know, become French, yes.
At least we'd have a team that has won a World Cup recently.
It's quite a change for a couple who, back in 2016, voted to leave the EU.
I don't think we even thought about it. I don't think you do.
I think you just go with the flow and you think, what do you hear on the news? And you think, oh, yeah, no, we need to leave. And
Or maybe it'll make Britain a better country. Yeah. If I had a crystal ball in, like, say, 3 years' time, suddenly we're in France. Yeah. You know, it's like, and now Brexit's going to happen. It's just like, oh.
For the UK, I still think leave could be beneficial for the UK. But for my own personal thing, I still want to be part of Europe.
The family live near the pretty town of Amiens in the Dordogne, where 17% of the population is British.
12,
you hear plenty of English spoken in the market here. There's even a weekly fish and chip van.
I've not had a single client who said to me, I want to put my house on the market and go back to the UK because of Brexit. Not one.
Terry Simpson owns 9 estate agents in the region. More British buyers now seem to be opting for smaller properties in order to keep a foothold in the UK. And across France as a whole, the British share of the housing market has shrunk. But after an initial dip in interest, Terry says, here in the British heartland of France, Brexit has been good for business.
As time's gone on, I think people have become either used to it or frustrated with it, or they've actually bought despite it. A lot of people have tried to work to the deadlines around Brexit, so last year was the busiest year we've ever had.
I think with a bit of cleaning up.
Yes.
Frida Parlett has just moved here from Scotland at the age of 80 to be close to her daughter Joanne. She's just bought a small house in Emme.
Now, I've got a big picture that will go up there.
Planning where to hang her paintings is the easy part. Planning for her healthcare and residency rights is much harder, as Britain still has to negotiate the detail of its relationship with the EU once the transition period ends. I asked Joanne if the family had a plan B.
There's no way that we would go home. If France didn't want us, we would look for another European country to go to. I voted to remain. I love free travel. And I feel sorry that that's been taken away, but we'll make the best of it.
See what you're going to do out here. Oh, it's quite big.
It's big, and we've still got some part.
Frida shows me her plans for the garden and says she hasn't yet met the people next door. President Macron is fond of saying that the British will always be neighbours. Frida's new life, A reminder that here in Eme, Anglo-French relations don't only take place across the Channel, but across a garden wall.
Lucy Williamson in France. The next big international climate conference is only 10 months away, and this time it'll be held in Britain. But the preparations for the UN summit in Glasgow have suffered a setback with the sacking of the woman in charge, Claire Perry O'Neill. She'd accused the British Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, of not having any serious discussion about the meeting. Now she's being replaced by a member of Mr. Johnson's cabinet. Our environment correspondent, Roger Harabin, reports.
Officials attending the Glasgow Climate Summit will be under enormous pressure from scientists to tie governments into tougher targets for cutting the emissions that are overheating the planet. At the previous major climate summit in Paris in 2015, the French pulled off an extraordinary feat, getting governments to agree that the world shouldn't ideally be allowed to warm by more than 1.5 degrees. But the UK began preparations relatively late and with fewer people, as Boris Johnson had culled the posts of many climate ambassadors when he was Foreign Secretary. Also, the UK doesn't have the support of the US President this time. That is crucial. As a result, Mrs. O'Neill said the Glasgow conference should concentrate its focus on different but potentially deliverable schemes, such as persuading major industrial sectors to agree emissions limits. She brought in consultants to advise her and ramped up pressure on the team that's writing the summit agenda. And she became increasingly frustrated with the role of the Prime Minister, who promised to chair a cabinet subcommittee meeting but hasn't actually got round to calling that meeting. Mary Cray, former chair of the Commons Environmental Audit Committee, said she was deeply concerned about Mrs. O'Neill's sacking.
My grave concern and the concerns of the climate community is that our environmental pledges, standards and commitments are being traded away in order to secure that free trade deal with Donald Trump's USA.
Downing Street has said lots of work's been done on the summit and the conference would be a big success.
Roger Harabin. There will be celebrations throughout this year to mark the 250th anniversary of the birth of the German composer Ludwig van Beethoven. The one thing everyone knows or thinks they know about Beethoven is that he composed some of music's greatest masterpieces while being completely deaf. But now an eminent historian, Ted Albrecht, professor of ethnomusicology at Kent State University in Ohio in the United States, says Beethoven may still have had some hearing. He says new evidence suggests that people's assumptions could be wrong.
As people observed him later in life, they observed a composer that didn't seem to hear everything, and so they assumed that he was profoundly deaf, stone deaf, whatever, at the time. But in fact, he could still hear them, at least a little bit, almost until he died. In 1818, he had gotten sufficiently deaf that his friends, when they were out in public, had to shout at him. And in order not to embarrass him or to make a ruckus in a restaurant, that sort of thing, he began to carry around blank books. These are the conversation books. And by the time he died, there were probably about 200 of them that were filled. And of those 200, 139 survive today. There are all sorts of accounts of his actually hearing. It's that most of us have never read them before. And there's also accounts in the books themselves. There's an account where he tells somebody, because I did not use ear trumpets, I've preserved the hearing in my left ear. In the case of the Ninth Symphony, Beethoven leaves his apartment to drive to the first performance of his Ninth Symphony on May 7th, 1824, in the evening. The last entry in the conversation books before he leaves is probably about 6 o'clock at night, and then we don't get any more conversational entries, with the exception of one, until they get home that night. And so for that period, for probably 5 hours,
Beethoven was speaking to everyone who was around him, and they were speaking to him.
The music of Ludwig van Beethoven, of course, and that was Ted Albrecht, Beethoven historian and professor of ethnomusicology at Kent State University in Ohio. And that's it from us for now, but there'll be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Valerie Sanderson. Until next time, bye-bye.